Okay, boy, that was a good one. Listen, I'm just glad that you're tuned in to Veterans Voice this morning on KBOO Portland. I'm JT, and we got one great guest going to be on today, Tom Hayden. Most of you probably know the name. If not, we're going to acquaint you with him, and I think probably just one of the most outstanding guests that we've had. So you picked the right day to listen to Veterans Voice, and we're all here from Northwest Veterans for Peace. Bill is here. Marvin's here. Good morning, guys.
Good morning.
And Marvin, we got a couple of announcements, things while we get Tom going up. Maybe I just told Marvin, and I hate to admit this, you know, they said don't ever admit mistakes, you know, when you're talking, but you got to do it sometimes. I forgot to bring the information on the Vietnam Memorial Traveling Wall, and because it's going to be here the end of this month, and I don't even see a calendar here, but my recollection was on the information I had, it was like the 23rd to the 28th or something like that. Maybe not
quite that
long.
Where's it going to be at?
Going to be up at Washington at the
Vietnam Memorial.
Yeah, up there on the hill. So we apologize for that. We'll try to get that information to KBOO later, or I'll get it to Marvin. If I get it to you, they can go on our website.
Yeah.
And and get it in the days coming. That's one of those things that it's when you want to see it and you don't want to see it. just kind of mixed. A lot of us have some friends on it, but I think it's maybe important for non-Vietnam vets to see,
especially with what's going on now in Iraq and Afghanistan, for sure.
Yeah, it. You've seen the wall.
Oh, I went back to D.C. when Laurel and I were going to go live in Vietnam when she got her Fulbright to teach in Vietnam. We went back to D.C. and I went to the wall. And it's pretty impressive. Impressive.
It really is. It gives you a sense of the magnitude of what happened in Vietnam. And I think not just Vietnam, but also that gives you the a real feel then for what happens in all wars.
Oh, yeah.
And while it's real emotional, first time I saw it, I just kind of lost it for about 3 or 4 days and had a little problem with it. But I encourage people to do that and take some friends with you that you know you can be with afterwards and stuff.
Well, right now, you know, I was looking in the paper this morning, and their count is in Iraq, 2,499 Americans have died. They didn't put down, you know, that probably 100,000 Iraqis are dead, but, you know, they're slowly climbing up there on the folks that are dying in Iraq, and they just will not.
It just keeps going.
Keeps going.
It doesn't seem very long ago when we were below 1,000, and you're thinking, boy, this is bad. We're going to hit that 1,000 mark, and then it was you passed that, and 1,500, and 2,000, and now we're pushing 2,500, and the only thing I just cried and go, when's it going to end?
Yeah.
When's it going to end?
You know, talking about memorials, that they still. If you go up to the cemetery, Bill, what's it called up there?
Willamette
National Cemetery. Boy, that's pretty. You look at that and you just think, you know, God, what a bunch of folks, you know. And then they have a little Korean War memorial up there, and it's got the names of the Oregonians who died in the war in Korea. And my uncle's on that, so. You know, kind of.
Yeah, well, because we're coming up on Memorial Day, and that's I think that the one at Willamette National for Korea is important to see. It's not as large as, but I still think it has an impact when you see it and you get a realization. And Korea's has kind of become one of those forgotten ones in a way, and I don't think that's right.
We're still waiting to get a hold of Tom, so he'll be in office in about 10 to 15 minutes, stuck in traffic. We can listen to Neil Young or talk on the cell if you want.
Tammy, can you find that? Tammy, can you find the
yes.
song?
I'm paying attention. Yeah, what? Which song?
Run Through the Jungle.
Run through the jungle.
Did I not play that?
No.
Yeah. No.
You played the wrong one.
That's all right. We'll get it.
You
bear with us a little today here on. Listen, can we do like all of the station breaks in a row right now, and then we won't have to do them later?
Well,
I mean,
the
they all
CD
know they're listening to KBOO Portland and Veterans Voice and Northwest Veterans for Peace. So here it is, only about 10 minutes past, and we've already got two of them in. So that ought to carry us for a while.
You know what? Run Through the Jungle is misnumbered. So I'm going to have to listen to the CD and find out which number it truly is before we can go to it.
Okay, Run Through the Jungle is
misnumbered. I think it's 13 or 12
no,
or 13.
It says it's 13, but it's not. That's what I just played.
Oh, would Creedence do that?
No.
Well, you know, while we're waiting for that and for Tom, you know, there was a thing on the landmines again. I got a message last night from the landmines, people from the landmines, and they were saying that still, Bush will not sign onto the protocol. And even though they had, I think it was 10 years ago, they had the meeting in Ottawa, and they, you know, it was voted in, you know, and the U.S. will not join that. And Bush says because he does not want to take away one of our options, you know.
Yeah, what?
Yeah.
We're
yeah.
In
what's
good what's company? What
yeah.
other
what's the option on landmines? You know, get a clue here about the damage worldwide that we'll never get rid of.
I'd like to say that the Mexicans better look out, because Bush is going to send the National Guard down there, and as the people at Kent State can attest, and the people at Jackson State, and the people at Homestead and Ludlow, they can all attest to the efficiency of the National Guard in carrying out the law.
Yeah, because
wouldn't it be something we landmine the whole border?
Yeah,
that's about as bright as they are. It almost wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah, and you know, May 4th. 1970s, when our good friends that we care about, Joe Lewis and Jim Russell, who live in our area, you know, they were shot. Joe was the first one that was shot.
Yeah.
You know, they shot him through the hip and then again through the leg, you know, through the ankle, I believe it was. And Jim, they shot him in the leg and put a shotgun pellet right by his eye, you know, and they, for what? You know, for what?
Yeah, if you had a rabid tiger or something about to kill a bunch of people, you know, that's a whole different matter. But that's just insane. Marvin, I do have the biography on Tom Hayden.
Go ahead.
Maybe we so we catch up a few of the things. Because Tom Hayden, after 40 years of activism, politics, and writing, is still one of the leading voices for ending the war in Iraq. Erasing sweatshops is something he's been on, saving the environment, reforming politics through greater citizen participation. He's been real active just in a lot of areas. And, in fact, currently he's writing and advocating for U.S. congressional hearings on exiting Iraq.
Mm.
And I think that's a real important thing that we can talk to him about when we get him on. In fact, this year he drafted and lobbied successfully for Los Angeles and San Francisco ordinances to end all taxpayer subsidies for sweatshops.
Ah, cool.
And that was pretty cool. He has recently taught at Pister College, Occidental College, at Harvard's Institute of Politics. He's written eyewitnesses account for The Nation. He still serves there on the editorial board about the global justice movement in Brazil, Chile, Bolivia, Chiapas, and India. He's actually the author of an editor of 13 books. And in fact, some of the most recent ones was Reunion from Random House. It's a brilliant book. It's kind of a political autobiography. And it's really quite effective, good reviews from people like the Christian Science Monitor and so forth. I wrote The Lost Gospel of the Earth, Irish on the Inside, Street Wars, Port Huron statement. So from the 60s, Tom Hayden has been one of the ones that's working on trying to change America. And I think after all the pretty much 40 years of work, he's a voice that deserves to be heard. He was a freedom writer in the Deep South. He was arrested and beaten in rural Georgia and Mississippi in the early 60s. He became a door-knocking community organizer in Newark's inner city in 64, part of an effort to create a national poor people's campaign for jobs and empowerment. And then when the Vietnam War invaded all of our lives so terribly, Hayden became an increasingly active opponent. He did teach-ins, demonstrations, his writings, and making one of the first trips to Hanoi in 1965.
Wow.
And it was to meet the other side and promote peace talks, journalistic contacts, and American POW releases. And I think that's pretty significant that in 1965 that he was willing to make a move like that. Then after leading street demonstrations against the war at the 1968 Chicago Democratic Convention, and there he was actually beaten, he was gassed, he was arrested twice, he was indicted in 1969 with seven others on conspiracy and incitement
and he was
charges.
With that,
Chicago 7.
The Chicago 7, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And, of course, after 5 years of trials, appeals, retrials, just a ridiculous process, he was finally acquitted of all charges.
Yeah.
And I think that's we should underline that. And after the political system kind of opened in the 70s, Hayden organized the grassroots campaign for economic democracy in California, which won dozens of local offices and shut down a nuclear power plant through a referendum. That's the first time that had ever taken place, that they were able to close one of those power plants. The organization led the campaign for Proposition 65 in 1986. That was the one requiring labels on cancer-causing products. Mm-hmm. And also Proposition 99 that tripled tobacco taxes to fund billions for public health and anti-tobacco incentives. Hayden was elected to the California State Assembly in 1982, the state Senate 10 years later, serving 18 years in all. He ran as a protest candidate several other times, resulting in a one-loss record of 7-4, which is pretty good.
So, Tom, she just said Tom will be on in about 5 minutes. So why don't you go ahead
minutes?
And play the This is the they did two anti-war songs, and this is the one that we were looking for, and I finally found it. So go ahead, Tammy, play it.
right here on KBOO Portland, and we're just so glad that you tuned in. It's a little bit different program so far today. That, I always like CCR. That's I think that's a powerful song, and we're talking a little bit about Tom Hayden. That's going to be on. Been delayed in traffic a little bit, and
Bay Area traffic.
Bay Area. It says maybe 3 minutes. You know, it's interesting, Marvin, that so many times in politics, you know, at least for me, I just get totally discouraged and think, but I think Tom Hayden is one that in political office, in spite of all things, consider this. Tom Hayden served under Republican governors for 16 of the 18 years.
True.
And twice was subjected to Republican-led expulsion hearings. And in spite of that, he managed to pass over 100 measures.
Wow.
While he was there. So his dedication to changing things and making things right, it's quite a list of things that he worked on to pass. Equality for access for disabled students to trigger locks on guns. It's just a wide range. Children's health standards he worked on, funding for gang intervention programs, and the list just kind of goes on and on. If you want to write down, he has a great website, and it's easy to access. It's simply Tom Hayden. In fact, all you got to do really is just type T-O-M-H-A-Y-D-E-N in your search engine, and it'll pop up. If you want to do the little more sophisticated route and do the www.tomhayden.com, you can do that. But either way, the website will come up, and I think he's the type of person, I think, that encourages us to keep on working and keep on trying to make change and right things that are wrong. He's lived, actually, in the Los Angeles area since 1971. Married to a Canadian actress, singer Barbara Williams. They share a son. And Tom has two other children that are now thriving adults from an earlier marriage to actress, activist, fill in the blank.
Yeah, Jane Fonda for sure.
Jane Fonda.
Yeah, one of the reasons that, you know, I thought about Tom Hayden to be on the show was through a friend of Bill's and I's, especially a guy named Bob Chenoweth. And Bob Chenoweth lives up in northern Idaho right now. And Bob was a prisoner of war in Vietnam for 5 years. And he talks about it and doesn't seem to have much. He has problems, but not a lot. But he was when he was in prison in the north, they walked him from the south up to the north, and he was in three different prisons up in Hanoi, in the north. And then finally, when they were going to release him in 73, they took everybody to what they call the Hanoi Hilton, which was a prison right downtown in Hanoi, and that's where they released from. But while Bob was in the prisons, he and about six or seven other guys, the enlisted guys, and they were from the south, captured in the south, taken north, and they started the peace committee. And the peace committee talked against the war. They wrote articles against the war. They talked on the radio against the war. They talked on their camp radio against the war. And he was telling me that there were two officers. One was a Marine pilot. And one was a Navy pilot. I think he was a lieutenant commander. And they both were really against the war. They came out against the war, and they spoke also on the radio and stuff. But Bob was saying it was really interesting that, you know, a lot of the other guys that were in the prisons with them were against the war, but they wouldn't talk about it. they wouldn't come out and say, you know, that I'm against this war in public, but they would talk about it in private, how they were against the war. And he said that really changed in about 1970, 71, he said, when there were a lot of younger pilots that were being shot down over Hanoi, and they were really against the war. But, you know, if they were against the war, why were they flying those bombing raids over Hanoi, you know? So he talks a lot about that. And when he came back and got was relieved in 73, he went with on a tour. He went to Hawaii, and he worked anti-recruiting stuff in Hawaii. But then he also joined Tom Hayden and Donald Sutherland and Peter Boyle and Jane Fonda and some others in what was called the Indochina Peace Campaign. And that's what I really want to talk to Tom about, is how that got started and what they did and, you know, how they worked on that. And he was part of that. And he was on the second tour as a ex-POW talking against the war. But on the first tour of the Indochina Peace Campaign was a guy named Bob Smith. And Bob Smith had been a POW in the South. He had been captured. He was Special Forces. He had been captured by the Viet Cong and was in prison for 2 years down there in the jungles, which were a lot worse down in the South. And Bob Smith went with him on, I think it was the first, we'll ask Tom about it, about the first Indochina Peace Campaign. And he figured it out real fast that he was being used to guard a factory down in the Delta for Diem's sister, I think it was. And he figured out real fast. And when he came home, he talked out against the war. He wrote a wonderful book that I finally found. And he talked against the war, and he traveled with IPC. And Tom's on the line now. Good morning, Tom.
Who's that, Chenoweth?
Yeah, it's Marvin. Bob's up in he's up in Idaho. He couldn't come down.
Oh.
But he said what he's going to do, he's going to listen to the show on the Internet.
Okay.
And could you we were just talking about the IPC, the Indochina Peace Campaign. Can you
George Smith?
Yeah, talk about how that got started.
All right, Marvin.
Can you turn him up a little bit, Tammy? I think he's a little quiet for it. This is JT, Tom. We've kind of reviewed your biographies.
Well, the I'll talk a little louder.
That's good.
Okay, super.
The pertinence to today's war in Iraq would be this.
Okay.
There came a time in the Indochina War when the public had really turned against it and was frustrated with the blood and the tax cost and the failure to address domestic issues. And so it became useful to really pressure Congress. And the Indochina Peace Campaign set up organizing operations in, I think it was seven states, core states, and a few more, where we thought we could influence the members of the Senate and the House. And we formed outreach committees that did a lot of demonstrations. They built facsimiles of the tiger cages, put them in front of congressional offices. It was the first time that we'd broken more into the mainstream. And my wife at the time, Jane Fonda, and I, and George Smith, Bob Chenoweth, Holly Near, the singer, a number of people in and out would go and give talks, small talks, large talks, as an instrument for, it's kind of a roadshow, kind of a teach-in traveling through the country. And we had a lobbyist in Washington who was trying to inform us about when there might be a vote to cut off the funding for the war, and that eventually came about in 1975.
Mm-hmm. So did you go to military bases? Did you ever get on a military base, or was it usually in the coffee houses around the bases?
No, Jane did before I knew her, and her first year of anti-war activism, she made a conscious choice that she wanted to speak to soldiers. Mm-hmm. And some friends of mine had been organizing coffee houses that were like a place for rap sessions and so forth on the edge of military bases, mm-hmm. like the Oleo Strut, I think was the name of the coffee house down at Fort Hood in Texas, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And she got on some of the bases, sometimes was thrown off. She also got on the base in Okinawa, and it was her desire to get on the bases in South Vietnam, but that was prohibited.
Yeah, for sure. You know, it was interesting because when John was reading your bio, you went to Vietnam in 1965?
Yeah, I was a kid.
My gosh. How was that arranged? How did you get to go to Hanoi?
Well, I don't really know all the details, but there had been a very strong New Left student movement and Black civil rights movement developing between 60 and 65. And just in 65, it developed into an anti-war movement. That's when the escalation happened, right?
Mm-hmm.
The first sending of 100, 150,000 ground troops after Johnson said he wouldn't in his 1964 election.
Right.
So one of the elements in this campaign was a Marxist professor named Herbert Aptheker, who had written a classic book on slave revolts in the American South. And I believe that the Communist Party of North Vietnam communicated a message of inquiry to him.
Mm.
Would he suggest some of these anti-war activists who might come over, because the North Vietnamese didn't know anybody's names, didn't know people. So he called a historian at Yale, Staunton Lind, who is a Quaker and who is a friend of mine from Atlanta and had gone down there during the civil rights movement. And Staunton thought about it, was a little worried about his job and how we would be received and so on. He said he would do it on the condition that he picked the third person. Herbert was going to go and Staunton would go. So Herbert said, fine. So as I believe the story went, Staunton called Bob Moses, who had been a leader in the Mississippi movement and gotten active against the war. Bob said no, and that left me. So he called me and out of nowhere and said something like, would you like to spend Christmas with me in Hanoi, Tom?
Oh, man.
So, you know, I'd never been out of the country.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was...
So how was your...
pretty naive.
Yeah, tell us what that was for you.
When you landed in Hanoi, what did you do? I lived in Hanoi for a while. My wife was teaching over there. I think it was 2000 we went. But, it's a completely different. But how did you feel? I mean, what...
Yeah. Well, every year I keep complaining to myself, why don't you go back? Everybody I met is dead or getting there.
And yeah.
It's changed so much. It was a mind-blowing trip because we went through Moscow to Peking, then it was called Peking,
mm-hmm.
5 days in China, and then a Chinese flight into Laos, I believe, and then from Laos, the International Something Commission flew us in.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was full of energy and just kind of bursting, taking notes, watching everything carefully. And I can only say it was something of a stereotype rather than a surprise. It's a beautiful green country, all rice fields, and you descend mm-hmm. very quickly to the airport in the outskirts of Hanoi. And then it takes quite a while to get in. You're met by a committee that had been set up to try to relate to the American peace movement and launch communications between POWs and Americans, organize other trips like Dan Berrigan's and Howard Zinn's and so on. And they're all speaking English, so that's sort of discombobulating. And they know things about America, but not necessarily accurate things. But they're doing their best. They're studying us. And it takes, I think it took 2 or 3 hours just to get across the river.
Yeah.
Because the, every bridge on the river had been bombed, and so you had to take these floating barges. And I just remember seeing peasants laboring in the fields, it seemed to me, all the way into Hanoi. And then when you hit Hanoi, you're in colonial France.
Yep.
All these yellow buildings, all these buildings from the time of the French occupation. And then we took a lot of trips to see bomb damage in the countryside, and tried to our purpose was try to make a report and pressure journalists to go. Nobody had ever been there, and we were able to get Harrison Salisbury of the New York Times an invitation, so he went. Not long after us, and the first story that he wrote was the first story ever saying that it was civilian targets were being hit, not military.
Now,
President Johnson had said it was bricks and mortar or bricks and steel or something like that. But it was clear to us that aside from how deliberate it was inescapable that many hundreds of civilians were killed, and many of the buildings blasted were pagodas or things that had no military significance.
Right, and while you were when you were in Hanoi this time that in 65, was that the time that the first time that an American POW was brought back?
No.
How many trips did you make
in the course of the war? I went back 3 other times.
Wow.
I went back in 67 on a kind of a incredible venture where they indicated through third parties that they wanted to release, they being the National Liberation Front or Viet Cong of South Vietnam, wanted to release 3 prisoners.
Wow.
As a gesture to the peace movement. I don't know if there was an ulterior motive, like some back-channel communication with the United States government, but I found myself in Cambodia for 3 weeks waiting. By now I was like 27, and it was a spooky place, Cambodia. There were CIA agents, all kinds of people hanging around the hotels, and they knew I was up to something because there was this rumor. The reason I was in Cambodia is because it abuts South Vietnam, and a vehicle carrying these 3 prisoners would have to be driving from the jungle in South Vietnam, somehow get across the Mekong River, and then into Phnom Penh and into the Viet Cong embassy, where there would be a press conference and the release. So I didn't meet these 3 guys until it had happened, and then the job was to get them flown all the way to the United States, because the Viet Cong did not want to go through a process with the American government that they were at war with. They wanted to do it through the peace movement or a civilian channel. So I tried to argue that with the American embassy and people who I knew to be in the CIA, and they were okay with it, but they were edgy, because who the hell was I, and what was the condition of these men, and above all, what were they going to say? But it kind of became a compromise. We took off from Phnom Penh. I went with them all the way back to New York, but at some point, I believe it was in India, some CIA personnel got on the plane and sat in the back and indicated they were there, and I think had some conversations with the guys.
Did the POWs while you were flying back, you went to India, did they talk about their feelings on the war?
Yeah. We went all the way to New York, so, I mean, I don't know how many hours. It seems like 80 hours, you know, around the world in 80 days or something, 80 days, rather. If the Viet Cong thought that these guys were anti-war, then they had been deceived. Went on to be one of the loudest pro-war guys, throwing out balls at the beginning of the baseball season, visiting with Nixon in the White House. And I don't know if he's alive, but he's in retirement by now. The other two were African American. One was very weak, and I think they released him partly because they were worried about dysentery and health problems that they couldn't handle. And I don't know. I lost contact with him after a few years. Remember, this is 40 years ago.
Oh, yeah.
30 years ago. And then the third, Jimmy Jackson, was the most interesting. He was a special forces operative who spoke Vietnamese and hid in the Ho Chi Minh Trail observing the caravan of North Vietnamese coming down for the Tet Offensive, or so he said, and he warned of the Tet Offensive. He told President Johnson that he thought American troops were going to be overrun in the South. He was kind of a broad-minded guy. He was a soldier, which meant he knew which side he was on and who he was fighting against, but he also understood why the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese were fighting, and I thought he was a pretty remarkable fellow, and he had been there quite some time. He had lived in a cage in the South for several years because, you know, it's a mobile guerrilla army down there. They don't have facilities, and so they take a prisoner with them. When you got to run from an American attack or whatever, you pick up your cage and everybody takes off. So he became quite familiar and close to the Viet Cong that he was with, but I wouldn't say that he was anti-war in any open sense or anything like that. And I don't know what came of it. It was just a humanitarian gesture for sure, but if it was supposed to have some diplomatic impact, I don't know. It
didn't work, huh?
No, I don't think so.
It was kind of interesting that when Ms. Fonda went to Vietnam, everything was great, you know, everything was great, and then that stupid picture and everything, but, that's really dogged her. But I read where you and her went back later.
Yeah, we went back in 74, just before the war ended, because we wanted to do a documentary, and we did it, but it had no market, really, because the war ended by 75. We were there with Haskell Wexler, who is a great cinematographer, as you know. And we filmed everything that we saw live, spontaneous interviews all over North Vietnam. We actually got down into the demilitarized zone. Between the U.S. position and the North Vietnamese position. You could see little yellow flags sticking up where the Arvin soldiers were, and little red and blue and gold PRG flags sticking up. It was in that area where the Viet Cong had already taken control of some territory permanently that would be basis for the launch of the future offensives. That's a pretty good film, but it probably...
Do you still have it?
Yeah, somebody has it. I have it. Jane has it. It's preserved.
What's it called?
It'd be nice to put it on DVD.
Yeah. What's it called, Tom?
I can't even remember what it was called. Something the Enemy.
Oh, Something the Enemy.
Sorry.
That's okay. It's a long time ago, man. It's a long time ago.
It's 31 years ago we did that film.
Boy, in all your spare time, if you get a chance to have somebody put that on a DVD.
and find a couple copies off to us.
That'd be great. Because of the mobilization of the students and workers and everything in this country, it had a big part in ending the war in Vietnam. What do you think's going on right now with Iraq and the American people, Tom? What's going on?
Well, I think students are less in the vanguard because they don't face the draft.
Right.
It's not that they're not involved. They certainly are the backbone of some demonstrations, like those big protests in New York at the Republican convention 2004,
mm-hmm.
when Bush was renominated. There were 1,800 people arrested there, nearly all of them on false pretenses and hysterical police overreaction, as we've seen. And I was there throughout it, and it's clear that young people were the backbone, students were the backbone of that mass mobilization. Most of the anti-war people I talked to seem to think that it was better in the old days, and this is less of a movement. I think our minds may be playing tricks on us. What's true is that the 60s were kind of exponential. By that I mean one thing would explode into another.
Mm-hmm.
Not that we were great organizers orchestrating this. It just happened the way fires catch.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the wind blows and fires catch.
Yep.
So there was a time of intensity in the late 60s that hasn't been matched. But here, according to the Gallup organization, which is still around, the number of Americans who think the war is a mistake, the war in Iraq is a mistake, has grown to majority proportions faster than during Vietnam. The GIs over in Iraq feel the same way. It's something like 30%, according to a Zogby poll, are for immediate withdrawal, and 50-something percent are for a withdrawal on a one-year timetable.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty close to the American public, and the military recruitment is very much in the tank, as you know. 30 or 40 recruiters themselves have gone absent without leave.
Wow.
They can't meet their quotas, and the Pentagon blames the parents. That would be us. And the budget is in desperate shape because of the annual $80 or $100 billion in expenditures on Vietnam instead of Katrina and so forth. And the Coalition of the Willing isn't even referred to anymore, that because there aren't any willing participants. I think actually the British will get out this year.
Oh, wow.
From the South. So the anti-war movement, in my opinion, has contributed to building a very strong oppositional force in America, in part because of the legacy of Vietnam. I see a lot of people who went through Vietnam out there in the streets.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it has the politicians jumping. Bush would like to start the appearance of a withdrawal, which is, remember, what Nixon did. Johnson started it, then Nixon. They brought the troops home but continued the air war.
Yep.
I think the congressional outcome is uncertain because of Iraq. Some Republican losses are going to be due, and there will be a struggle in 08, which will begin in 07, over the presidential primaries. And remember, both Republican and Democratic candidates will have to face the voters first in New Hampshire and Iowa, where anti-war forces are very strong. So this is going to be a continuing headache and diversion for the United States for as long as it continues the war. And I don't predict on that. I never would have believed that Vietnam took 12 years, right?
Yeah.
this may be a long war. Best to prepare for that, but hope for a shorter time frame than that.
Do you think that Kerry will run again?
Yes.
You really?
And Gore?
And Gore, huh?
Let's say that they're actively exploring and doing the things that you have to do to be in position to run. Kerry has changed his position on Iraq, finally, to one of proposing a withdrawal of all U.S. troops in a 6 to 12 month period now. Gore has been pretty good in his public statements. Edwards has come out for a withdrawal. I don't know if he's going to run again. Feingold, as was first, he came out for an 18-month withdrawal about a year ago.
Yeah.
But climbing Mount Hillary is going to be the problem, right?
Probably.
Yeah. Do you have any advice on that?
Well, I don't know.
Yeah, Tom.
He's going to have to reposition.
Yeah, we only have a couple of minutes, but Bill has a question for you, and then if we have time, I do too.
How does this withdrawal square with the permanent construction that we're doing in Iraq?
Well, there's no way of knowing what the U.S. intent is. I don't know if the U.S. knows what its intent
yeah.
is. You know, like, they do what they can get away with, I suppose. Certainly, it seems to me there was, from the beginning, a permanent plan for permanent occupation.
Yes.
You know, beat the Iraqis, withdraw some of the troops, but have an outpost in the Middle East.
Yeah, I agree.
Both houses, I don't know what the president will do, but it's quite amazing to me, both houses have accepted the Barbara Lee language in the budget that none of the money shall be expended on permanent military bases. Of course, the president is used to waving all that off, but it's a significant measure of how far things have come. And it seems to me, as long as the U.S. is unclear on permanence or not, it feeds the insurgency's perception that the U.S. intends a permanent military occupation, and so the war goes on.
Right. You've written quite a few articles on it. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, on Iraq. In fact, the notes on the London interviews and the London report and speech to peace.
I'm glad somebody's reading it.
There's a lot of people reading it, I'm sure.
I'm writing from an undisclosed location, trying to do my best to apply what I know to the situation. But it's a hard war to read.
Boy, it is, isn't it?
Yeah, Tom, one of the things that I look at, you know, trying to evaluate some of the similarities between Vietnam and Iraq, it seems like perhaps one of the differences is at least in Vietnam, there was a unified unification primarily among the Vietnamese people, where all of the Vietnamese people basically wanted to have one country, and they wanted to be Vietnamese. If that's a least reasonably true statement, isn't one of the difficulties in Iraq is that we've made a real mess with at least three major opposing parties, and how in the world do you solve any of that?
I think you're generally right. We might overstate how unified the Vietnamese were, but certainly at the very least they had fought the French and fought others.
Mm-hmm.
And there was an organizational machinery. You know, there was the Viet Cong, there was the North Vietnamese government, all the way down to the grassroots. People were organized, and they had leaders, they had platforms, they had demands, they had proposals, they had negotiators. Here, the similarity, it seems to me, is that the Iraqi nationalism or hatred of the U.S. and the British is on a par with the Vietnamese.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Except for the Saddam period, which was kind of a top-down centralization, they don't have a nationalist movement that they all agree on as being their common movement. They don't have a single political party.
Mm-hmm.
They seem to be a fractured resistance.
Along that line. What about the war on terrorism? The enemy is terrorists. We don't have an Iraqi enemy or...
Yeah, well, that's right. We play into it by being against a tactic, which is terrorism,
yeah.
violence.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, the truth is, I think that the Iraqis are more unified than we think, just as the Vietnamese were less unified than we thought. For instance, there are... between 7 and 11 insurgent groups. A very large block of them are people from the Saddam era. An even larger group would be Sunni in general. They perceive themselves as being wiped out in a pro-Iran, pro-Shia, pro-U.S. dispensation. But even within the... So that's, we're told, that's 20% of the population.
Yeah.
But then even within the Shia majority, half of them want the U.S. out, according to surveys, and half of them, more or less, are associated with Muqtada al-Sadr, who has led two uprisings, military uprisings, against the U.S. So... the Shia are split over the question of should the U.S. Well, no, I think they want the U.S. to leave, but they're split over how soon. The Sunni are in favor of the U.S. leaving now or shortly. So there's a majority of the Iraqi Arabs who are for withdrawal, even though they may have religious differences or other differences, cultural differences between them, and a bad taste for good reasons, in the mouth of the Shia towards the previous Saddam Hussein regime.
Right.
So it really, there's only one group, the Kurds, bless them, they deserve a country, but apparently in this world they'll never be able to have one.
Well, Tom, I tell you,
So the Kurds are the pro-U.S., they're armed to the teeth, they're pro-Israeli, but they're like 10 or 20% of the population, so...
And, Tom, unfortunately, we've run out of time. We were just starting to get into the good part here.
Well, I'm sorry, but all I'm trying to say is most of that population is anti-U.S.
Yep.
Half the parliament wants the U.S. out within a year. I think it's going to fall apart from within.
Yeah, it's worldwide. Yeah,
it really has. Tom, they're giving me the signal that we have to say goodbye, so bless you, keep doing good, and we'll talk to you soon.
Yeah, I feel something tightening on my throat.
Okay.
Andrew's waiting in the wings also.
Okay,
thanks,
bye,
guys.
Bye, Tom.
Hi, how are you?
Good. See you soon. Thank you for listening to Veterans Voice on KBOO Portland. Tammy, if you take us out, and we'll turn it over to Andrew.
The time is 10:02. You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. Coming up next, People Rise Up.